Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear Figs. Because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts, and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your Figs? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room, listening to this podcast? Wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
For over two decades, a predatory sex offender committed a string of offences against young women and girls in Poland. Failings within the Polish criminal justice system allowed this ruthless paedophile to offend with little consequence. Subsequent failings by the UK immigration would allow him to make West London his new hunting ground. This is what happens when a relentless sexual predator is left free to hunt. This is the case of Andrzej Konowski, the Beast of Poland. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case, it's going to be one of those where I show some frustration within the failings that, without a doubt, I will be discussing with you today. I'll be interested in your views. We start off in May 1997. A 12-year-old Katerina Kaniewa, she was living with her parents in Hammersmith, West London. They were a happy family. The family were a Macedonian immigrants that arrived in Britain in 1995. And Katerina was described by her family as a really bright, quiet girl. She was doing very well at her Holland Park school. She dreamt of being a teacher or a pianist. So I guess we're introduced to a child who has a sensitive nature and also a creative spirit. And whenever we talk about somebody in the past tense, your heart breaks because you know that those dreams that were simple pleasures and ideas in childhood never got to be lived. Her family will never see her become a teacher or watch her master the piano and take those dreams forward. Because on the 22nd of May 1997, Katerina's just walking home. As usual, she's finished school for the day. But what that little girl doesn't know is in that moment where she's just going about her daily route, thinking about homework, what she's going to eat for her meal that evening, the things that we do at that age, she isn't aware that she's being watched. In fact, a man's been stalking her. So while she's home alone, she couldn't have imagined what was about to happen. This man breaks into the upstairs flat on Iffley Road. He jammed the living room door handle with a chair and then he forces Katerina into her bedroom. He sexually assaulted this 12-year-old girl, choked her with a cord. It had actually been given to her as part of a birthday present. He choked her with something that would have been a gift. It's so hard to conceive this kind of action playing out. Katerina's father, Trete, he arrives later at the flat because one of the reasons for him returning there is he's concerned. He's tried to connect with his daughter, he's called her on the phone. She hasn't answered. And Trete knows straight away that that is not an appropriate response. He expects her to answer, and if she isn't doing, his belief is something bad might have occurred. Maybe she's had an accident, but certainly it was enough to make him go home, and he rushed home from the college. When he couldn't open the living room door, initially he thinks to himself, well, she's probably getting changed. He could hear noises from inside, so automatically his assumption would be that his little girl was there and that maybe she's moving around. He knocks on the door and he says, it's Daddy, open up. He gets no answer. And you can imagine, can't you? This is completely outside his normal experience with his daughter. There's trust between he and her. Why wouldn't she answer? So at this point, he looks through the keyhole and he sees that his daughter's school bag is there. So he knows that this is a warning sign because she isn't responding. Why isn't she responding? So he knows something sinister is potentially occurring, and he looks under the door and he sees a man's black boots. Can you imagine the fear, dread, panic that would set in that moment? His daughter's bag's in there. Automatically, the assumption is she's there. And then there is this foreign person in that room, somebody who should not be there. And you notice that by these men's black boots. Trey J begins to shout. He kicks frantically at the door and he isn't able to get in, so he runs downstairs. And at this point, he literally comes face to face with the intruder that's been in his house. He's clutching a bag and he'd actually jumped from Katrina's first floor bedroom window. The only thing I want to add in there is I wish that as he had fell, he had broken his neck. Or I don't know, maybe he would have misjudged and landed in the road just as a HGV lorry followed by three buses, 27 cyclists, and one of those road rollers for the tarmacking to flatten out the street. If they'd been passing, that would have meant this story was, in my opinion, a far happier one than it's going to be. But basically, that's what occurs. So Trey J then demands to know what's been going on in his home because he presumes that this guy's a burglar. And one of the things that he says in this interaction is that the man was just totally cool and calm and collected. Bear in mind, he's just been caught in his home. Even if he was a burglar, there is a criminal offence taking place and he's essentially been seen. There is now a witness to that crime and he just doesn't seem to care. He also notices that he's got blood on the side of his face. And then at this point, the man says nothing. Just looks at him, turns, runs. Trey J runs after him and he keeps going until the guy turns around and threatens him with a knife. At that point, the same offender carjacks a woman who's just driving in a car and he flees the scene. Now, what's really tragic about what I'm telling you now is that, of course, what we know about Trey J is that he's an incredibly loving father, right? This is a man whose sole concern was about his little girl, and he's completely unaware that the intruder that he believed had just burgled his home had choked Katarina and left her with that cord that was part of a gift wrapped still tightly around her neck. He calls the police, he returns to the flat, and at this point he finally manages to break through the living room door. I imagine he was in such a panic he would have done anything to get in there. That's when he discovers his daughter's body. He manages to cut the cord as the officers arrive and they find him crying, calling out her name, absolutely distraught. The police and the paramedics were not able to save her. And I imagine that her father struggles massively with this because, as we know, he left trying to figure out what was happening and met the offender, the murderer of his child. But the other side of that is that the cord was around her neck. So he will be so conflicted. Could he have got there earlier if he'd known that she was there choking to death? Could he have made a difference and so on and so forth? And I genuinely hate the echoes that these kind of crimes create because he would think about that day in and day out, I have no doubt, for the rest of his existence. the last photo that they have of Katrina, she's there on her 12th birthday, smiling with her birthday cake. Just the extraordinary ordinariness of life, things that we celebrate, take for granted. And for that family, had no idea in that moment when the flash of the camera went off that that would be the last one that they'd celebrate together. At this point, there's a murder investigation launched straight away and the authorities start to search for a suspect. The investigators did discover hair on Katerina's cardigan. Also, they found fingerprints on the window that the man had leapt out of, but they didn't match any of the suspects that they had on police records. Then they put out a £20,000 reward. They want to get the killer ASAP and they ask for lots of information that can ideally lead to the capture of the killer. But years have passed. No one would be brought to justice. What is deeply upsetting, and that many of us will understand the reason behind initially, is that Katerina's father, Trejay, was initially the prime suspect. So aside from the fact that he's going through this hideous loss, hideous trauma, this powerlessness, helplessness, the guilt that he'd probably met the man who snuffed the life out of his child and that he'd got away, he's dealing with all of that. And then the eyes are on him, believing that he murdered his child. Now, I appreciate we all accept that usually in these scenarios, it is indeed a member of the family. And also when somebody finds an individual, the likelihood of them being the murderer again increases. So there's reasoning behind that. But this is also the man who called the emergency services. It's the man that they found distraught. And for him to be put in those direct lights as far as illuminating the possibility that he was the murderer, it tore his life apart. He spent time in police custody. I mean, the officers who interrogated him genuinely didn't believe his story about an intruder. But even worse than the interrogators not believing him, his own wife, Katerina's mother, the cleaner, she didn't. She actually attacked him at the police station and he just wanted to hug her. But she was convinced that potentially he was the perpetrator in this crime. I cannot even get my head around that stuff. I really can't, as far as how somebody would manage those feelings. This man has lost his child. Now people are accusing him as being the murderer. But on top of that, your own wife is angry. And I appreciate heat at the moment. If the police are interrogating somebody, you make a connection, you build a picture, a story, and you think, my God, what if? And of course, she's protecting the now memory of her child. She wants somebody brought to justice, and she believes that if he could potentially have done it, that she probably wants to kill him there and then. But the damage that's done to individuals like this, he was a completely innocent man. He just wanted to be in the arms of his wife. And suddenly, he stands accused. It's also beyond belief to me that it takes a while for the police actually to track down CCTV footage of him chasing the intruder out. I mean, so there's hair on the child's body that clearly doesn't belong to anybody within the family. There's fingerprints on the window panes that don't belong to any of the family. Just throw it out there. Hair, fingerprints, unrelated to any of the parties in the household. But let's just go with that. We think he's guilty because, you know, he's related and found the body. With respect, at this time frame, I will also admit that I think that a lot of police just wanted to clear a lot of cases up, and the sooner they could do that, the better. Even if that meant that, I don't know, shall we say totally innocent people went down for crimes that they didn't commit, or at least they tried to get them sent down for crimes they didn't commit. So yeah, turns out everything he told them was true and they just needed to find the CCTV footage of him doing exactly what he said. And you know what the problem is with all of that? By the time that was done, all of the damage had occurred. Trejay and Ciclina, they split up in 2000. Now, it's worth noting that when a child is murdered, or even dies traumatically, but certainly murder, is one of the most profoundly disturbing experiences for parents to experience, then there is a higher level, a considerably higher level of you splitting up from your partner. Whether it's the fact that you blame one another, your reminders of what you no longer have, whether you just cannot move past that moment of loss and the other is trying to desperately, these things certainly have the ramifications that last a lifetime, and for relationships they often end them. Also, they split up after he attempted to end his life, and that was something that he did more than once. And I completely empathize. I think that to lose a child is something that transcends any understanding of what pain is and has its whole own universe. If you lose your child and you know that you would have done anything to have protected them, but you didn't have a chance or choice, then the idea of going and being with them is probably very
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
During in moments. He lost his identity. He lost his reputation. He lost his sense of safety in a world that he would have once trusted. And he didn't have the option to look after that little girl when she needed him. And that will have played on his mind again and again and again. And when people are killed traumatically, or when people take their own lives, or when people are murdered, often the family members become way more at risk of taking their own life. So we expect this kind of impact. And we have to, as I said, additionalize being the individual who was essentially accused of being the murderer and how that affected him. 2 years after Katerina's brutal murder, West London yet again is in the headlines. And that's because there's a disappearance of a 19-year-old student, Elizabeth Chow. So she is, at that moment in time, studying law and business at Thames Valley University. And she'd been living with a Vietnamese family in West Ealing, West London. She came from a really close-knit family. She was very well-loved, very well-supported. Her parents described her as a responsible, caring, considerate girl. In fact, they also described her as, quote, an angel. On the 16th of April, 1999, Elizabeth leaves college. She's walking back to the family home. And earlier that day, she'd gone in, gone through the ordinary motions of signing in an assignment before she went on to have a drink at the student union bar. Brings back memories. Back in the day, when we weren't all emailing, a lot of people out there are probably like, what did you mean she was handing it in? Like handing it in? As in physically handing it in? Yes. When I was younger, you actually had to physically do things like walk places and hand assignments in. It wasn't all emailed, simple as that. But that's what she was doing, that completely ordinary task. So she goes off to the student union bar, obviously meets friends. So she's last seen on CCTV. She's walking past a police station, that's on Uxbridge Road. It's about 6 p.m. That was less than a mile from her home. And that's where she just disappears, never seen again. They had loads of public appeals. The police put out loads of information because they wanted to find this young woman. They got no leads. And that meant for her family, literally no closure. And when I was researching this, they're always heartbreaking. I don't ever pretend for 1 minute that I don't have that feeling in the pit of my stomach where the emotion within all of us lies. But there was this really poignant part of her story in the fact that the family have kept the daughter's bank account open because essentially they hope that one day she might use it. Or of course, the alternative, the killer might use it. But either way, it would give them some answers. Her father's kept his mobile number the same ever since Elizabeth went missing. He doesn't want to ever feel that should she want to or be able to get in contact, that she wouldn't be able to. Her brother stated this: "We have no closure. We will live with the pain every day. My parents are particularly distraught. They've not changed their phone number or moved house in the hope that she may one day return." When people just disappear, when we see them on those posters, all too often it's easy to forget that they belong to other human beings, loved ones who are living their lives with the void of that individual's absence. Just 9 months after Elizabeth disappears, another young woman disappears. This is from the same road. I say that with that level of same road for a reason. People don't go missing, number one. It's really, really rare. The vast majority of people who do go missing, they just turn up really quickly. Some never turn up. Some turn up a year down the line. But for the vast majority of individuals, they turn up real quickly. You don't hear of people just disappearing on the same road. You know, particularly if it's another young woman who, I don't know, could fit the same victim type of a previous individual who's just disappeared. Blows my mind. If somebody on the same row that you live disappeared, and a few months later, another one disappears from the same row, you're going to be thinking, hey, have we got a serial killer around us? Genuinely, because that doesn't make sense. So this particular young woman is 27-year-old computer graduate Lola Shinkoa. She's American and she's of Nigerian birth. So like Elizabeth, she lived in Ealing. And then on the 3rd of January 2000, after just spending a day working as an office temp, she was working at Entertainment UK in Perivale. Basically, she'd been there as she was expected to be. It was just an absolutely box standard day. Now, the belief is that she did make it home. They think that, tragically, she did get home at some point between 4 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. But, unfortunately, she couldn't get access into her house on Swincombe Avenue because her sister and her shared a key, essentially. And at that moment in time, her sister wasn't home. She had the only key. And that meant that she couldn't get in. So Lola, she then catches a bus to Haven Green. She gets off the bus outside Burger King. This is on Ealing Broadway. Just disappears. Just vanishes into thin air. It's another family with absolutely no closure. And for Lola to just disappear without any explanation, it's completely out of character. She was really young, happy. She was full of life. She came from an incredibly loving, supportive family. This is not a girl who was just gonna disappear. She had everything to live for, and she was living in a way that suggested that she knew that. Now, when you think about the proximity in time and in place, two disappearances, right? At this moment, the police do think, okay, they may be linked. Maybe, whatever. But that's what they're saying. They think at this moment in time, they may be linked. I mean, for all of us listening, we're like, they would definitely be linked. It's literally the same row, the same place. It's the same situation. Anyway, this is how it goes. I agree. I may sound infuriated because I know this story. You'll just have to bear with me on this. But I appreciate it's only a possible allegation that it could be the same person. They wouldn't absolutely know without evidence or bodies and so on and so forth. Now, later that same year, another young woman goes missing from West London. This is 20-year-old Polish tourist, Iwona Kaminska, and she basically vanishes from Hammersmith in July 2000. She'd only been planning to stay in the UK for 2 weeks. She was visiting friends. She was hoping to improve her English. She'd been in the country for 4 days. 4 days when she disappeared. She'd been lodging with a friend in Wandsworth, southwest London, and she'd also managed to find a job at a Polish-owned business in Hammersmith, West London. So essentially, she's come, She's obviously feeling out the possibilities and potential of staying, and she's managed to create a relative amount of success within those 4 days. She disappears on the 13th of July 2000, and she's going to meet a friend after work at 7 p.m. She just doesn't show up. Now, Ivona, she came from a really close-knit family. They contacted her every single day. They were immediately concerned when they didn't hear from her. And her friend, who was equally concerned, it was completely out of character. Bear in mind, Ivona is in a country that she isn't familiar with, and she's been relying on friends to stay with, and she's not going to be going out anywhere else because she doesn't have those links. It's very suspicious that she's not in contact. So that friend goes and reports her missing the following day. Now, the police were stumped because they try to trace her, and it's like she's just vanished into thin air. And they do try to find out what's happened. They put information out regarding her being missing. And the years just pass with no new leads, and the case ultimately goes cold. Now, authorities do later down the line offer £10,000 of reward for anyone who can lead to Ivona's discovery or lead to the arrest of her abductor. But to date, she remains missing. Her father, Jan, stated this. No contact from Ivona was so out of character. We instantly knew something had happened to her. Someone took her from us all those years ago, and we need answers to move forward with our lives. Again, another family caught in the purgatory and limbo that these kind of disappearances create. Now, bear in mind, I've covered those, and at the same time, in parallel, we have the authorities being absolutely no closer to solving 12-year-old Katerina's murder. She'd been murdered by this point 3 years earlier. So police don't know who is out there, don't know if they'll strike again, but they understand that a very violent predator is not being brought to justice, that a very violent predator is walking the streets. The police actually have to wait up until 2002 for a break in a case. This is when a 21-year-old student was bound, raped, and choked in Acton, which is in West London. She'd been lured to the bedsit because she believed it was available for rent. Her attacker had made her feel that there was some potential for her to find a place that she could stay. But when she got in there, she just got attacked. It was all a ruse to get her alone and vulnerable. And also, of course, what do we know from that? We see that he wanted some time. He wanted an opportunity to have her at his will. He raped her, he beat her, he strangled her. He did that for 3 hours. What's amazing, and thank God, she survived. At least she was able to tell the authorities about her attacker. And it's at this point the police are able to identify, and more than that, arrest a 46-year-old Polish national, Andrzej Konowski. That man had been running our streets for decades. Decades. In May 2003, and we have a lot to go through, guys, believe me. The fact that he's been apprehended right now, the fact that we're talking about his trial, just don't think this is the end of it. It so is not the end of it. So at trial, Konowski claims the sex was consensual. Of course he did. Of course he did. We see this so often. Sorry, let me just get this right, Konowski. You're saying that my client, that I'm representing in this court of law, consensually came to the flat and allowed you to strangle her, bind her, and leave her in a precarious scenario somewhere between life and death during the attack. Yes. Really? It was consensual. I'm really glad that we have a jury all over the age of 9, because that's around the age frame we felt we'd need to get to ensure that they'd have the common sense to send you down. Obviously, trials don't work like that, but if they did, that would have been the appropriate thing. I also apologise that I was trying to do some kind of Polish accent in my responses. I just didn't feel I could do a British one. Well, apart from with the barrister, of course. Anyway, this absolute baloney doesn't convince the jury. He gets convicted of rape, and rightly so. So at this point, he's sentenced to 9 years imprisonment, and this is at HMP Belmarsh. During that incarceration, one of the things that they do is they take DNA. You may see that nowadays where people go into police stations or where you see people checking into a prison. If you see any of the programs that are on television, where you'll see those entry points, they often will use the swabs, and that goes into their database. Because of course, if you've got somebody who's a criminal offender, you want to make sure that you can connect them with other crimes, and it makes it possible. So at that moment in time, his DNA gets submitted to the national database. And of course, the police are genuinely hoping that he's going to be linked to other unsolved sex attacks. But when the results came back, they were blindsided. They were really, really blindsided. Because Kanofsky, he wasn't simply the predator that he had imagined, a man who they believed could have raped other women. It turned out he was the match for the hair found on Katerina's clothing. He was responsible for the 12-year-old being sexually assaulted and strangled to death 6 years earlier. At this moment in time, Kanofsky is obviously arrested. He's now under suspicion for Katerina's murder. However, when the authorities tell Kanofsky that, as far as they're concerned, he is now being considered responsible for this murder, he's like, totally wasn't me. Like, what? Sorry? Why? Why are you saying it wasn't you? I wasn't there. Really? Yeah, I totally wasn't there. How was your hair there? Mistaken identity. You're saying, you literally are saying this, aren't you? You're literally saying that the hair that we found at the crime scene that clearly links you to being the predator who carried out the murder, you're saying that that is a case of mistaken identity? Yeah. It was like my hair, but it wasn't my hair. It's hair, but not my hair. It's someone else's hair that was there. That's what I'm saying. You're going to go to prison for a very long time, sir. Literally, that's what he says. Mistaken identity, mistaken identity. As if that's actually something that can occur when your hair is literally at the scene of the crime. I'm labouring that point, but it shows you the kind of individual we're talking about right now. So aside from the fact that the authorities are now horrified, they've got a child killer. They start digging. And boy, should they have dug a long time ago where this guy is concerned, because they are utterly horrified by what they dig up. So first of all, it transpires that he shouldn't even have been in the UK. He was here illegally. And also, I am going to tell you about his history and what the authorities in Poland knew about him. And also the failures that led to what we're talking about right now. Because what they discovered paints a picture of one of the most dangerous predatory paedophiles and sex offenders that I've ever come across. When he entered the UK, he was actually on the run from the law enforcement in Poland. And this is because he'd been involved in a massive string of sex offences. So he was actively escaping essentially jail, which I'll come on to in a few minutes. So this guy's rap sheet is unbelievable. It is uncanny that he ever had the opportunity to leave Poland and to come to Great Britain. So let's look at him a little bit deeper. So Kanofsky was born in Warsaw in Poland. That was on the 29th of March, 1956. His father worked as a builder in a construction business. His mum was a housewife. They were a really respectable family. In fact, they were a supportive family as well. Now, they later moved to a place called Mława, and that's 30 miles from Warsaw, and that was for his dad's work. I appreciate when people move, there can be a level of fracture in a child's foundation. We all know the importance of peers and friends, and if you have those encroached upon, yeah, it can cause some kind of emotional distress without a doubt. What was clear about Konofsky from the get-go is he's a problem child. He's described as a problem child, actually, by his family. It's not me just saying he's a problem child. I will list why shortly. He was certainly a problem adult. Anyway, what's recognised is in his early years, he was considered quite a loner, quite nervous, actually. He was seen as quite an anxious child. He didn't have very many friends. But in spite of the fact that he has this anxiousness and nervousness around his peers and he struggles to make relationships, he's constantly getting in trouble. So he's looking for that trouble, he's finding that trouble, he's getting into that trouble. He's repeating whole cycle, as just noted by me. Now, this is strange on the level that he has a really stable family. And that's not what we would expect to see in a well-adjusted child. So I think we can all agree that there is a level of dysfunction very early on within him. I don't know, running through his veins in his DNA. Throwing it out there, not saying it's an actual fact, just saying could be running through his veins in his DNA. Anyway, he gets involved with criminality really, really early and he starts to graduate. So as a teenager, he's stealing money from his parents' savings account, which is one of those things that suggests a very clear, I have no boundaries. Also, I don't care about consequences. If you're robbing from your own parents, firstly, you don't think there's going to be anything too aggressive and hostile when they find out. And secondly, it shows a level of disrespect that is quite staggering because they're your parents. They're already paying for you, essentially, to just exist. Now, after he's taken this money, he just runs away from his home. He just uses the cash to wander around the country. One could say, well, maybe he was scared of the repercussions. No, I don't believe that. I think he was paying himself from his parents' cash to be able to get up to exactly what he wanted to do. And I think creating some distance between himself and his home would have been important because this man is malevolence personified beyond a shadow of a doubt. What we're talking about with this man is a natural born sexual predator. I truly believe that. Konofsky actually gets convicted of his first known rape in 1973. He's barely 17 years of age. At that point, he's sentenced to just 3 years in prison. And do you know why? Do you know why? Do you know why? Because the court were like, oh, we could give him a stern sentence. And I watch things like the world's toughest jails. I expect Poland to come down hard on people. I've seen it on said programmes. So at 17, in that country, having aggressively attacked and raped somebody, one would expect 3 years to be considered a very lenient sentence. But this is the bit that makes me go, mind blown. The court believed he was unlikely to reoffend. Sorry? So what's that? Yeah, we think he's unlikely to reoffend. Why? Why? Why do you think that? He comes from a stable family. He's stolen from that stable family. He's literally taken the savings. He's gone around the country, probably attacking people sexually. We think he's going to be fine. Where is your evidence for him being fine? We don't have any. It's literally not even in the research. We don't know what we're doing. We're just throwing it out there. I don't know, we've seen criminals that we think look more likely to offend. I give up. If you think in any way, shape or form that an individual who at 17 years of age rapes somebody is not going to continue to rape again, then I think I live in a very different universe. Understandably, he gets released, just carries on. In fact, he carries on to a point where he becomes a sexual predator. And this is the key. The consequences were not strict, strong. They certainly didn't reference the severity of the crime. And it gave him a very powerful message. Oh, well, at the end of the day, you don't really get a serious sentence for doing something that literally ruins people's lives. When he starts work, he gets a job as an ambulance driver. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? And again, I bring in the kind of individual who can at times take these jobs. We all know that people who work as ambulance drivers very much on the whole would be lovely human beings who want to make a difference. But if you want to have people in positions where they are vulnerable, these kind of jobs gives you access. And again, it means he would be traveling around. It means he'd be trusted because he looked responsible. He looked like a person you could trust. And that gives people a bias in their belief systems about the kind of human being you are. It means that they will be on the back foot when suddenly you find yourself being affected by them, aggressed by them. You're not expecting an ambulance driver to do that. And this is where he commits a string of sexual offences, both on girls and young women all over the Warsaw area. He'd actually drive around looking for them because he would know that people would pick strawberries on the side of the road. And I don't know, some of us growing up in the 80s and early 90s may have found ourselves doing that as well. Blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, bilberries. I didn't care as long as they were free and my grandma could put them in a pie. And she did. And she could. And they were delicious. Absolutely delicious. But it doesn't happen, I don't think, as much these days. But it was a very common experience for me when I was a child. And certainly when we're talking about Warsaw and the fact that these would be free, it makes sense that they'd be picking strawberries on the side of the road. So he would stop the vehicle. Then he would run to the girls, grab them, drag them into the undergrowth and rape them. This is a man who really doesn't care about people seeing things because he feels untouchable. Now, on one occasion, he even pretends to be lost. And when a woman leaned into his car to speak to him, he just wound the window up and he trapped her. And then when she's trapped, she can't do anything about it. And he sexually violates her, he assaults her. So he is consistently acting out his fantasies with these women, and he is consistently escaping any kind of capture. Now, he does get arrested numerous times, to be fair, and he even manages to escape from prison on two occasions. Sorry, how can anybody ever?
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Find themselves saying a statement like that. It's like Ted Bundy, isn't it? Ted Bundy. At the end of the day, escapes once. You know, what could possibly go wrong if we don't keep an eye on this serial killer? Oh, he's going to escape again and murder other innocent people. And this is the irony. When we're talking about these individuals, if people escape and they have this particular kind of predatory behavior, it can cost lives. And it's unforgivable that any of us can talk about these individuals having access to have done that. Now, at one point in Poland, this man, if I can use that term, and I use it very, very loosely, he was wanted in relation to 25 rapes of females between the ages of 10 and 27. One male rape of a fellow male inmate, 6 attempted rapes, and 1 attempted murder. He had once, on one occasion, appeared in court facing 70 sex and violence charges. Now, the belief is that he carried out 15 rapes during just 1 9-month period in 1978. He's a prolific sex offender. Does anybody else want to go back to the individuals who made a decision that he won't reoffend when he got that 3-year sentence and just, I don't know, give them a little slap on the face. Wake up. Stop being stupid. Look what you've done. Because there is a duality in this with respect. If people make decisions that are not based in evidence, that certainly lead to other individuals being horrifically affected, then that duality has to exist, that they, as well as the offender, need to take some responsibility. Because he should never have got 3 years, and he should absolutely have been supervised from that day onwards, ad infinitum, end of. And if he'd ever been caught for another crime, he should never have got out again. That's how it should work. Now, ultimately, he does get arrested, and he's convicted in 1980 of multiple sex crimes, which is unsurprising when you've just heard that massive list. Now, the prosecutors, they asked the judge for 25 years. They want him to get a minimum 25-year sentence. They recognise beyond a shadow of a doubt that he posed a really serious danger to society. They feared his crimes were only going to get worse. And ultimately, in spite of asking for this, he was sentenced to just 15 years. 50. Did this guy have like a fabulous hairstyle at the time that just made people go, he can't be that bad? However, ultimately, he's only given 15 years. Think about it. The list I've just gone through, 15 years? And at the end of the day, it makes me ask the question, was it potentially Ted Bundy's judge who actually gave him that? Because he seemed to have some really weird views, you know? Hey, Ted, really sad that you won't be stood in this court presenting as a lawyer. Could have been a different path. No, it couldn't, Judge. It couldn't have been a different path because Ted Bundy's a major, massive serial killer, necrophiliac rapist, and that's who he is. Was never going to be in your courtroom presenting any legal framework or case. Couldn't even win his own with respect. But I digress. I do have some issues with these sentences. These are women and children who are being horrifically affected by these kind of decisions. Now, it gets even worse. Can it? Yes, it can. They give him parole. Yeah. In 1991, after serving 11 years, they're like, you're great. Off you go. It'll be fine. What else could go horrifically wrong? Now, after he gets released, he buys a flat in Moava, and true to form and completely as to be expected, just starts reoffending again. So following Konofsky's release, which I believe should have come with a major alarm on his head that created some kind of, I don't know, purge sound whenever he was within 500 feet of anybody under the age of 50, female per se, that didn't happen. I'm just saying that's what should have happened. So he gets released, and then 14-year-old seventh grade student Agnieszka Grzybicka, she vanishes again. This guy's got let out, and now a child has disappeared. All she was doing was going home from her school in Weber. That's on the 9th of March, 1982. Konofsky's questioned, of course he is, because at the end of the day, he's a known sex offender and predator, but he gets questioned but not charged. Now that girl, that young teen, she's never been found. And yet what we know when we look back at this man's MO is that he would follow girls home from school. That's part of what he did to achieve his goal, which is to, of course, identify a victim and to harm a victim. Then in 1995, Konofsky's arrested and charged with raping another two girls. One's an 11-year-old, one's a 14-year-old. It's unbelievable. How dare they have let this man out? And it's gonna get worse. So whilst he's in custody, because he has raped these two young girls, he needs an operation on his hip. So the judge just says, you know what? Let's just temporarily release him on bail for 3 months. Yeah. Let's allow him on bail, unsupervised, for 3 months. I mean, what harm can this man do? Bear in mind, this man has already escaped from custody twice and is a known serial sex offender. But what harm can he do? He needs his hip operating gone. He's an invalid. He will require rest and recuperation. He will not, under any stretch of the imagination, imagine that fleeing is a good idea. Maybe, I don't know, fleeing to a country where you could even get an operation on the National Health Service. Throwing it out there. Honestly, the judge genuinely does this. Try and wrap your head around that. Bails him. Lets him go. Unsupervised. 3 months. So what does he do? Yeah, surprise, surprise. He uses the proceeds from the sale of his flat the year before to just buy a fake passport and to flee to the UK. So he enters the country illegally on a tourist visa and he gets in. Now, Polish authorities, they had actually informed Interpol about Konofsky's escape. So his fingerprints were disseminated, subsequently sent to 125 countries, including the UK. Because, I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there, you might want to know the kind of sex predators and murderers who are coming across your border. You'd certainly want to be able to fingerprint them to make sure you weren't accepting any, I don't know, what's the technical word for it? Wrongans in across your border. So, as I said, UK was given his fingerprints. But he wasn't arrested at the border. Well, wasn't arrested, and I'll tell you why. Because at the time, border guards were not required to take fingerprints of visitors to Britain. What could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? Just come in. I'm a hideous sex offender. Are you? Well, I wouldn't know, because we don't take fingerprints. But they send you fingerprints. Yes. We have all the fingerprints of the wanted predators who are fleeing their countries as far as Interpol's concerned. But we just don't bother using them. We just think, you know, just let people have a sense of trust. We just believe that it's better to give people responsibility and allow them to just be a better person if they're an escaped criminal coming through our border. Funnily enough, we were actually trained by a Polish judge. Yeah. Sorry, it's driving me mad, this. Because as much as I use sarcasm to deal with what I consider a complete breach of trust in the way that systems work, I do it because what actually I'm talking about is the absolute abject failures that lead to people being murdered that could be prevented. And at the end of the day, this guy should have been fingerprinted. So of course, he's swan through, arrives in England, and Konofsky's used these fake documents, so now he's been able to secure himself a job as a dry cleaner in Acton, West London. Straight away, start stalking girls, start stalking young women in the area, and this culminates on the 22nd of May 1997. This is when Konofsky spots a new target, and that new target was 12-year-old Katerina Kniewa. That's who he sexually assaulted and strangled to death in a home. A month after that killing, he actually got arrested for theft, and he actually was identified as having overstayed his tourist visa. So at this point, you're going to think, well, good, because now they're going to have to investigate this. They're going to have to tie these threads together. He's a child murderer. He's a perpetual rapist and predator of women and young children. So, of course, they're going to do the work because these things matter. He gets held at Campsfield House, the detention centre in Oxfordshire, and he's kept there for 2 months. But at this time, still, the authorities seem to know nothing about his criminal history in native Poland. And they obviously have no idea about the fact he's just been involved in Katerina's murder. So at this point, because they aren't doing, as far as I am concerned, the basic checks, he gets released into British society. So he's back on the streets. Now, he does apply at this point for UK residency. It's unsuccessful, but then he just disappears. It's incredible to me that at this point, he's managed to stay off the authorities' radar. In spite of the fact, I kid you not, he had a life-saving bypass heart operation on the NHS in 2001. Thank you very much, NHS. Thank you very much, authorities. Not only do we not track the background of this predator, we save their life. I just wish something horribly wrong had happened during that operation. I don't know. Maybe one of the surgeons got too carried away by doing a TikTok video. Sadly, that wasn't available back then. I don't know, put some on MySpace. I think that was around then. Anyway, in 2002, he does get tracked down. And again, at this point, is identified as living illegally in the UK. So the order that he has to be deported. Yeah. And we're all like, okay, good. This sounds good. He's being ordered to be deported. And that means that he's going to get deported. And we're all like, how does that work? Just let's throw it out there, Em. Feeling a little bit uncertain about the rules and regulations. And I don't know, just keeping track of what could be considered heinous human beings going around reaping havoc, mayhem and destruction on other people's lives. I'd like to know how we ensure that they are kept an eye on. So this is how it goes. When you're found at this point to be living illegally in the UK and you're ordered to be deported, what they do is this. You're ordered to be deported. Okay. What's next? Well, this is what's next. You need to turn up on this date and then we deport you. So I just get to carry on just being out there doing what I do until this date. Absolutely, until that date, but we're British, we like to be on time, we essentially will insist that you are there at that moment in time when we deport you. Fine, I'll be there. Good. See you on the 5th. See ya. That's what happens. So, ordered to deport, but just doesn't turn up. What a surprise! What a surprise that somebody with so much in their background and obviously is aware that if he gets deported back to Poland, he's going to get arrested. He's never going to turn up for that deportation. And this is the problem. What the hell is going on when human rights cause the destruction of human lives? And that's what we're talking about right now. Human rights usurp human lives in that system. The authorities are now very aware, of course, that there's a sexual predator who has managed to slip through the net. They know that he's somewhere where he's entered and he's got away with staying in the UK. They know that this guy's a dangerous paedophile. They know that he's a sex offender. And they also know, to their horror, that he's been being left in West London unchecked for 7 years. Yeah, they come to the realisation. Suddenly they're joining the dots together and they realise he's been free to stalk, to attack, to kill his victims. Now, it had taken the 2002 rape of the Korean student for Konofsky to finally be identified and to appear on the authorities' radar, which that then led to the discovery of his involvement in Katerina's murder. But what the hell has gone on that he's had this freedom? They didn't check his fingerprints. They didn't track his movements. And because of that, these women were horribly, horribly affected and some lost their lives. Authorities also start believing that it's likely he was involved in the disappearance in 1999 of Elizabeth Shao, also of Lola Shenkoya in 2000, and Ivona Kaminska's disappearance later that same year. Because Konofsky was working at that time in a dry cleaning shop on Uxbridge Road. That's just very near where Elizabeth and Lola disappeared. However, in spite of the police presenting Konofsky with all of this and their theories behind it, he would never admit responsibility. And that does not surprise any of us, does it? This is the same guy who was like, hey, I wasn't even at the crime scene. You've got a case of mistaken identity. It's your hair. It's my hairstyle. It's literally just a hair. It could be part of my hairstyle, but it's somebody else's. It's a mistaken hairstyle. Mistaken. Have you got an identical twin? No. Then you're a massive liar. See where you're going. So anyway, this guy's never going to accept responsibility. And he knows that the police essentially at that point have no hard evidence because Elizabeth, Lola and Ivana's missing person cases didn't turn up any evidence where bodies were concerned or forensics could lead. And that means that all of those women's cases are still open to this day. And that's heartbreaking for every single member of their family because they have no sense of closure. And I have no doubt whatsoever that what we're talking about today is a serial killer, but arguably the family would like to have had that hard evidence. Whether that ever comes, whether they ever discover the bodies, who knows? But it sounds to me like they have their guy without a doubt. In March 2004, finally, Konofsky's tried at the Old Bailey. He's 48 at this point. Bear in mind, 17 when he carried out his first rape. 31 years later, finally, this guy is in the Old Bailey. There's a jury of 4 women, 8 men. It takes him 2.5 hours to find him guilty of Katerina's murder. Showed no emotion whatsoever when the verdict was read out. Why? Because he has no emotion. This man is devoid of anything human or compassionate. Empathy? I don't have any. Compassion? Don't want it. General morals? I left them before birth. Literally. This guy shows no emotion. He doesn't care. He's just so narcissistic that I imagine in his own head, he was just playing out some kind of scene that whilst he couldn't control it, he wasn't willing to demonstrate any lack of power. He didn't want anyone to see his helplessness demonstrated in that moment. So on the 31st of March 2004, the judge orders that he be kept in prison till you die. Till you die. You're dead. You're dead. You're not getting out. There's no having if operate. We don't care. If you need your knees doing, mate, you're going nowhere. Going nowhere. Actually, we might ask one of the other inmates, maybe who are a bit handy with DIY, they can do it for you in your cell. Throwing it out there. Can't say we don't care. I genuinely appreciate the fact that that judge was like, never getting out. Never getting out. So he sentences him to a full life term without any possibility of parole. And in the judge sentencing statement, the judge stated this: I would be failing in my duty in light of the evidence about your behaviour both in Poland and this country if I did not ensure you spend the rest of your life in prison. You took the life of a child who was just beginning to enjoy what this country had to offer. Her and her family are refugees from hardship abroad. It was a life of great promise. You ended it in circumstances of great violence and terror. The detective who was involved in bringing Konofsky to justice, he said this: he is probably the most dangerous sex offender I've ever come across, and certainly the most prolific. Yeah, that's what he said. And yet the old judge in Poland didn't think he was going to be a risk again, right? Just turns out he wasn't just a risk. He was such a risk that a detective died in the wool, hardened to their job, still considered that that offender was the most prolific they'd ever had the misfortune to incarcerate. Katerina's mother, another massive victim in this case, like all the families are, Ciklina said she hoped that her daughter's killer burned in hell. Just going to throw it out there, Ciklina. Not to make light of this whatsoever, your pain is something you neither deserve. The burden that you carry is not something that you should have to. The loss of your family unit is diabolical to me and to those who watch this, but I think we are all assured that that man will burn brightly in hell, I don't know, for eternity. Eternity, eternity. Forever, ad infinitum, burnt. Pokers in orifices, that kind of stuff. That's the kind of thing that I like to think about when I consider individuals like this horrible human being. 23rd of September 2009, this is only 5 years after this guy was convicted, Konofsky actually died in prison. He was in HM Prison Frankland and he basically died from heart failure. So one could say that maybe the bypass that he had back in the day wasn't necessarily the best that he could have got. Throwing it out there, maybe they'd had one of their trainees pop in, just have a go. Don't like the look of this guy. Does any of the trainees need any heart bypass operation experience? No? No? Does any of the, anybody in the cafe, volunteers who show people around the hospital, is any of them? Well, I know they're not trained, but give them a break. This is how aspirations are formed. Oh, hi, Margaret. Come in. I know you should be serving the spaghetti bolognese, but I've got a job for you. Sorry. I can't help it.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
My sarcasm takes over sometimes, but I just like the idea that maybe the operation that he had on the NHS was a failure. I also feel it's unfair that he only had to serve 5 years before dying, but that's maybe because the devil wanted him quicker. And what is really sad, in spite of the fact that I'm glad that he is no longer breathing air or costing money, we have to remember the fact that what's really happened there is the non-closure for all the families who hoped to God that one day they'd be given the answers about what happened to their loved ones. When an individual dies and takes secrets of the offences that they committed, and he will have committed other offences, and those families deserved to know what happened to their children, their siblings, their friends. It's what people need, the power that the predator uses over them by refusing to ever tell them what happened. That in itself is a form of being truly powerful in their minds. You know, he believed that he could control their pain and he refused to alleviate it to any distance at all. And that's appalling. Now, following his death, one of the things that the authorities did, and I understand why, is they did this public appeal. And the reason for that is they were desperate to try to connect him to any other unsolved rapes or murders. But in spite of that, there have been to date no new developments, which is really upsetting. The errors in the Polish criminal justice system, they literally allowed Kanowski to offend for 3 decades. 3 decades! And also, we're not gonna just let them be responsible, because the errors by the Home Office and UK immigration officials, they allowed him to carry on offending here. They allowed that man to carry on offending here with deadly consequences. Whilst it really annoys me, the fact that that Polish judge only gave him 3 years for rape the first time, I will also have it noted that there is some similarities that we have in the UK as well. So there are often lighter sentences imposed on individuals of that kind of age. So he only got 3 years at 17. If he'd been an adult, so a year later, he would have probably got double that. But the courts, as they said then, hoped that there would be some kind of reform. He came from a respectable family. Therefore, he'd be fine. Stable background. But can we take a moment? If ever we should be more alarmed, it's that somebody grows up from a good background and acts this way. It says something more malevolent within their nature. There's no foundations and reasons behind their actions. It's something deep within them. It's hard wiring, as far as I'm concerned. When I think about the classic signs of future violent behavior and a future violent offender, he evidences that in his background. In Kanowski's case, he starts by stealing money from his family when he's a teenager, then he goes on to rape. And let's be honest, we cannot for 1 minute imagine that they were the only two crimes that he was actually responsible for. In the interim between them, he will have done other things, he just won't have been apprehended. Alarm bells should have been ringing. And early intervention for these kind of individuals, it is not just important, it is paramount. Without it, you are looking at not being able to stop violent criminal behaviour. And even when you have those interventions, often they're not successful. How can, at times, a predator truly change? How can a leopard change their spots? I believe in hope. I also believe in a whole heap of reality. When you look at what should have been placed in his environment to prevent an ongoing escalation, He would have needed to have had therapy. He would have needed to have been given some kind of rehabilitation. He would have needed to have been given opportunities to truly address those problems. That early intervention is absolutely paramount if you're going to even attempt to stop that violent criminal behavior. Because adopting that rehabilitation approach in sentencing, we've got to encourage it when we deal with young offenders, because we don't want to screw up their entire lives with harsh punishments. You know, if somebody's constantly taking cars and stealing them, and we think about the fact that at 15 they're doing that, but at 19 they might be in a relationship with a child, working a job, the transition in those 5 years is usually quite huge, and you don't want to mark them and make their lives a misery for the rest of their lives for these terrible decisions that they made as a kid. But we're talking about rape, where violent and sexual crime is involved. You have to acknowledge that the bare minimum where rehabilitation is concerned is intense psychological treatments to address their offending behavior. Because genuinely, if that doesn't happen, you can't change what isn't acknowledged, right? And certainly, you need to be able to keep a complete eye on the developing changes in that individual to know whether they are safe to live in our society, or a supervision if you have fears about their potential. Either way, didn't happen. When you look at many examples, and there are many examples of juvenile offenders who have gone on to kill, believe me, more often than not, we look at their backgrounds and we can see that there's been a long history of offending behavior, that have been punished with lenient sentences, they've been allowed to reoffend time and time again. And you know what happens? The offenses get more serious. The consequences don't change the crime. They escalate the type of offences those individuals involve themselves within. Now, even though Kanofsky was only ever convicted of one murder, come on, let's call it as it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's likely he was a serial killer. He constantly stalked his potential victims, just as he had done in Poland. He was living nearby in West London when Elizabeth and Lola disappeared from the same road. That was an area, as far as I'm concerned, that was his hunting ground. And shortly after, we've got Ivona Kaminska. She also disappeared from West London. All three of those women absolutely fitted Kanofsky's victim profile. And also, Kanofsky worked nearby to where the last woman was seen. Sadly, the police have never been able to find that hard evidence to pin it on him. And that's a real shame. But what's the biggest shame, as far as I'm concerned, and I think you can tell from the level of frustration I've voiced during this video, what's frustrating beyond belief is for decades, it was the system that allowed him to offend. He didn't have any fear of being caught. He committed crimes in broad daylight, bodaciously willing to chance capture. That kind of a criminal is unusual, even by serial killer standards. Without a doubt, when you look at his history, his actions, there are clear signs of antisocial personality disorder. He's got psychopathic traits. Also, it seems he had a specific victim profile. He went for girls or young women who looked younger than their actual age. He targeted immigrants. Why did he do that? Because he saw them as more vulnerable. He could also elicit their trust, couldn't he? He was an immigrant. He understood. He was very organized to some degree in his offenses, because he was able to use deceit and manipulation to coerce individuals. Another trait that's really important to note and is described by his victims is that he always seemed very good at making a first impression. So he was always dressed neatly, his hair was combed, his shoes were clean, and he was friendly. So that put people on the back foot. We all know, of course, that organized serial killers tend to be that way. They've figured it out. You're going to manipulate people. You've got to be able to engage with them. You've got to make them feel safe. Even when you're carrying out the crimes, you might use some of those tactics. Even when you've got them tied up, you may promise them that everything's going to be all right. We see these kind of personality traits play out in these scenarios, but he was good at that. He'd also offer to help his victims. So again, instantly making them feel that they could trust him. This is typical of our predators. And one imagines this is also potentially how he gained entry to Katerina's flat. She was just 12 years of age. She probably opened the door just thinking it was her dad arriving home. Or maybe he said he was somebody coming to check the gas meter and so on and so forth. How many kids just blindly believe that grown-ups aren't going to harm them? Katerina was used to good adults in her world. How could she possibly have known the monster that she was allowing into her home? How could she have ever contemplated the horror that was about to unfold? What she wouldn't have known is that he was playing out that typical MO. Kanofsky followed young girls home. It was part of his fantasy. It was part of how he chose and selected his victim. She could never have comprehended that. The day she was murdered as well, Katerina had just found out that she'd come top of a class in English. The jubilance she would have felt knowing that she could have gone home and told her mum and dad that she'd done so well. You know, her story being carved in our culture, coming from a place which was more challenging and being offered the education and not just embracing it, but taking it on and thriving as she was doing. She would have embodied something so beautiful. She would have gone on to succeed. And our culture would have gained from her within it. It's as simple as that. Because of the fact he murdered her, she never got to tell her parents that. She never got to say, "Mum, Dad, I came top in my English class." And even though when you think about all the things I've been telling you, I appreciate that might seem so small for me as a mother, as somebody who was once a child, who very rarely did well in her education, so knew what it means to feel proud. I'm sure that Katerina would have walked home all the way, imagining the pleasure and pride on the people who loved her faces, just hearing the excitement and the sense of achievement that she would have felt in that moment of expressing that to the people that she spent her life with, her parents. This is what those predators do. They don't just steal lives, they steal moments of meaning. They steal futures of meaning. They rob society of meaning. I'm glad he's dead. I have a problem saying that. I know a lot of you will say, well, I wish he had suffered more. I wish he was an individual who, at the end of the day, had had to serve out his days in prison. But I'm going to tell you something that I believe. When you think about 31% of violent offenders fitting the psychopathy scale, and this guy does, do you think his life would really have been bad in prison? Nah. He raped a prisoner when he was inside. He would have likely formulated ways of being powerful, getting what he needed, retaining that sexual predator behaviour and just being allowed to get away with it for the next however many decades. At least we know that he likely died in fear and pain. And even though that won't bring great comfort to the families, on his way down to hell, one hopes he was clutching his heart in pain. I think I sounded a bit bitter there and resentful. Probably because I am a little bit bitter and resentful on this one. Can't believe that people made so many failures and the result is what I've told you today. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.